It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria this morning.
We're missing Maria. She's hungover.
She's nursing it at home.
Yeah, no, she forgot to reset her alarm this morning. I guess nobody told her about the time zone change, so.
New year, new time zone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the law.
but she'll be with us again next week, I'm sure, right, assuming she remembers when to set her alarm for.
That's right. Well, and
it happens to the best of us.
That's true. It does. All right. Well, obviously the big news this week and for weeks to come is the tsunami that, of course, happened
Sunday.
Was it Sunday?
It was Sunday.
Just after our show last week.
And the scale of the tragedy is just unimaginable. I'm sure everybody's aware. It's been the only thing on the media all week long. But there's been some interesting aspects to it. The U.S. The Bush administration's response to the need for aid and airlifts into the devastated areas has been really very, very slow. It was only yesterday that the U.S. increased its donations tenfold to $350 million from $35 million. The last 4 days in a row, in fact, the Bush administration has increased its aid amounts from what was originally, I think, $15 million, which is less than half of what they're spending on the inauguration parties. It's amazing the priorities of this administration. That's still less than what we're spending literally every day in Iraq is what's going into the relief efforts for the tsunami. Japan, with a much smaller economy, has announced a donation of $500 million. At the same time, there's been a lot of private charity and donations also, which has been really heartwarming to see. And I think you mentioned, we might as well mention it here, the offer that a local store is doing today.
Paint the Town Ceramics painting studio, which is down in University Village, is offering from noon till 6 p.m. that any money you spend there, 100% of that will be contributed towards the humanitarian crisis. And I don't know if they mentioned the specific organization they're putting it through, anyway, so that's today, noon to 6.
What's the name of the place again?
Paint the Town Ceramics.
Okay, in University Village. Okay.
University Village.
That's a nice gesture.
Yeah.
In the meantime, it's been very interesting to see some of the human skill. I mean, we always think of natural disasters as something that human beings don't have any agency in, but as a matter of fact, you know, any time you have, like, you know, hurricanes, and then you find out that the mudslides that resulted in the flooding was in large part because of the deforestation of the landscape, and you find out that in say Central America or someplace like this, so you find out that what human beings have done either to the environment or in terms of the organization of the political infrastructure of the affected countries has a lot to do with how many people actually wind up dying. And that's been very much the case again this time, particularly because the affected countries in South Asia, many of them are particularly Sri Lanka and Burma are particularly poor countries, and affected by civil war as well. But there was also an interesting aspect that a lot of the devastation caused by the wave was actually much worse in areas where the coral has been mined, where the coral that is offshore would usually act as a breaker to the wave so that it didn't come as far inshore. And that's been stripped away in a lot of areas for mining for products that are made out of coral. So once again, we have a case where a natural disaster that would have been bad anyway was made much, much worse by what human beings did to their environment. And that's an aspect of the story that really hasn't gotten very much attention.
In addition, obviously, there's a lot of organizations that people can contribute to. You had mentioned before we went on, like American Friends Service Committee and
Doctors Without Borders.
Doctors Without Borders are ones that you yourself had given to. On the on the KAXP website, we now have up, I believe, a link to Mercy Corps, so you can give.
They're very good as well.
And obviously, every region of the country also has their own different organizations.
Yeah,
that are
yeah. Maria gave to Dr. Zepp, whereas in Oxfam, she mentioned on the phone.
All right. So, plenty of outlets for people to give monetary support, and that's obviously going to be needed for a long time to go.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually a situation that's getting steadily worse day by day, and the airlifts that are going into the affected areas are actually much less than what's needed to cope with the scale of the disaster.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, that's enough of our cheerful good news for the new year.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's more where that came from. Last week we ran out of time on, as we do a lot of weeks, with the trying to cover everything in just a short 30 minutes. You had mentioned that the White House is doing some regulation changes to do with our forests.
Yeah, 2 days before Christmas, and this is something that the White House has routinely done, is to bury the bad news in the, as slow a news cycle as possible, so that, you know, usually released on a Friday afternoon, because Saturday is the day when the fewest people watch TV or read their newspapers. Well, the same thing happened before. They released it late Thursday, 2 days before Christmas, the day before Christmas Eve, when nothing was going on and nobody was paying attention over the holidays. The White House released sweeping new regulations, dismantling many of the environmental protections that were put in, ironically enough, by the Reagan administration in the mid-'80s, having to do with the management of the national forests and what happens when timber companies or mining companies want to come in and rearrange our natural heritage. It used to be that until these new rules have been taken effect, that you had to have environmental impact statements, that there was this whole level of bureaucracy that you had to go through in order to go ahead and do your clear cutting or your strip mining. You don't have to do that anymore. In fact, in the real world, almost all of these timber sales on public lands have been litigated. That won't be happening anymore either. The White House has taken out all public comments on lands. They've taken out all requirements that endangered wildlife be protected. If these rules had been in effect 20 years ago, we never would have had the spotted owl controversy. The owl simply would have died out. And it gives local managers who are frequently susceptible to pressure from timber industry representatives and from communities who are dependent on timber for their livelihoods, essentially the autonomy to go ahead and order these sales and these cuts under any conditions. It's a very disturbing new development. Something that that has left the environmental groups who pay attention to these kind of things pretty much aghast. Once again, a reminder that this is the worst environmental administration probably in modern history of the United States. They have at every level of the Department of the Interior, the Forest Service, all of these different public agencies, they have put in charge of our natural lands people who have previously worked for their livelihood for the industries that they're not supposedly regulating. It's been very disturbing. So this was an enormous gift. This was like giving the timber industry the Hope Diamond for Christmas. It was just really appalling.
Yeah, one hell of a Christmas present.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Well, with that, then I guess we jump to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Well, a lot happened this week having to do with Iraq. The fighting, of course, continues. There were more casualties in Fallujah, a city that was a relatively small city that was supposedly cleaned up weeks ago. But the biggest political development that happened this week was the withdrawal of the one Sunni party, the Iraqi Islamic Party, who was originally going to participate in the elections this month. Has now pulled out, saying that their demand that the elections be postponed until a later date when the security situation had improved were being ignored, and that they weren't going to participate. This means that one-third of the country that is Sunni Muslim has nobody running in the election coming up at the end of the month, and we'll have nobody in the new administration. Now, what the United States is planning to do, apparently, is to go ahead and appoint Iraqi Sunnis to positions of power in the new administration so that there will be some representation. This raises the question of how this is any different from the current situation where we have essentially U.S.-appointed people running the country. It's not a question of Iraqis electing Iraqis at all, because many Iraqis don't want to have anything to do with the election, because they don't want to have anything to do with the United States occupation, and the United States is still perceived, quite correctly, I think, as calling all of the major shots as to what happens with public policy in Iraq. And it's going to stay that way until the United States pulls out.
Yeah, just 30 days now till the supposed big day in Iraq.
Yeah, and there have been a whole spate of car bombings and assassinations of Iraqi police and National Guard members, and that level of violence is going to continue to rise between now and the elections, almost certainly. Now, there was also some other interesting developments this week here at home. The American Civil Liberties Union actually just before Christmas released some documents that suggest heavily redacted documents from the White House that were ordered released by a judge after they had been refused under a Freedom of Information Act request that suggests that there was an executive order signed by President Bush that allowed for the use of torture on detainees from the war on terror in Afghanistan, from the Guantanamo Bay detainees, and later from the prisoners that were held in Iraq at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Iraq. This was something that has been widely suspected but never proved. Now, this is pretty much a smoking gun suggesting that it wasn't simply a case of a few bad apples here and there in the armed forces that were carrying out these acts of torture, but that it was a systemic policy of the Pentagon and of the White House that was approved at the highest levels from a secret executive order signed by President Bush. This is something that the White House does not want released, of course, and something that they may continue to be able to stonewall based on national security grounds. But we're going to be hearing more about it because in the next couple of weeks, I believe on January 12th, but sometime around then, we're going to get a hearing for Alberto Gonzalez to be confirmed by the Senate as the new Attorney General. And Gonzalez, you may remember, is the person who, in his role as White House counsel, penned a number of memos defending the use of very aggressive interrogation techniques against Iraqi prisoners and Afghan prisoners, calling the Geneva Conventions quaint and essentially defining torture so narrowly that almost any aggressive interrogation technique, any extremely abusive technique, would not be defined as torture. Another interesting development with those hearings coming up, at which Gonzalez is certain to be asked about this. He is no longer the White House counsel, and the new acting White House counsel very quietly this past week posted on its website new regulations for the definition of torture, much more broadly defined than it has been in the past, so that what the military is and the CIA is allowed to do now is much more restricted than it had been in 2002, 2003, and 2004.
Yeah, and if people want to see that that memo, that's at the U.S. Justice Department website.
Yes, it is.
All right. Anything else on Iraq or
no? That's enough for now.
All right. Well, last week we started the Eat the States regular best of and worst of the year, and or undercovered and
undercovered, overhyped and undercovered
okay.
stories of the year.
All right.
Yeah.
So and last week was overhyped.
We did the overhyped last week, and so we wanted to talk a little bit about the most undercovered stories of the year this past year. There were a number of them. Probably at the top of the list were a couple that were really global crises that got very little attention. One being global warming and climate change. This is something that's going to literally result in the deaths of millions of people in our lifetime and the lifetime of our children. You know, the science on it isn't disputed any longer. The Kyoto Protocol was ratified this year with the agreement of Russia to join in. This leaves the United States as basically a rogue nation when it comes to climate change, and the Bush administration's actions over the past inaction over the past 4 years and probably over the next 4 years will be the single most criminal act, I think, that this administration will be remembered for of the many.
I was going to say there's a lot of competition.
Yeah, there is. But in terms of the simple scale of the devastation that climate change is going to result in, and not just to human beings but also to animal species, it's estimated that up to half of all animal species on Earth are going to be extinct as a result of the climate change that's being put into effect, and something could have been done about it. We don't know how irreversible it is. There's a lot of evidence coming out now to suggest that even if we stopped the emission of all greenhouse gases now, that that it may be feeding on itself, and it may be an irreversible process at this point. But we haven't stopped those emissions. We're in fact increasing them here in the United States. You know, through the use of gas-guzzling SUVs and the various industries that pollute the atmosphere. This is a story that's begging to be told and hasn't been told. Another one along those lines has been the global AIDS crisis. You would think, by what you hear in the United States through the use of protease inhibitors and so forth, that the AIDS epidemic has been over, and nothing could be further from the truth. This is probably a pandemic, particularly in Africa and South Asia, that will be responsible for more deaths than anything since the Black Plague in medieval Europe. It's something that requires, as with the tsunami, requires a vast international response, and we're seeing it with the natural disaster, but we aren't seeing it with the AIDS pandemic, which is going to kill far more people than the tsunami did.
And targeting primarily women in Africa as well.
Women and children, yeah, and that's something that again was really not in the media here in the United States at all in the year 2004.
Yeah, I think like on World AIDS Day, that's about the only time they really decided to cover it.
And not even then, very much. And they certainly don't cover the lack of contributions by Western nations in general and the United States in particular. I mean, our response to this has been just pathetic. As is our response to almost anything in Africa, and of course Darfur was another example of that this year, where a great human tragedy is unfolding, and because it's in Africa, nobody cares. You just shrug your shoulders and say, "Well, that's Africa again," and go on about your business. Believe it or not, people there care about life just as much as people here do. It's you shouldn't have to say something that basic, but it is true that people do have that attitude. There were any number of other stories that we could talk about here. The resurgence of nuclear power was certainly an interesting one, where we have the United States particularly exporting, but also here at home. In fact, there was an item in the paper just last week that a city in Alaska is setting up a nuclear power plant, which I believe is the first one that's been ordered here domestically in the last 30 years. But the United States, under the Bush administration, is particularly aggressively pursuing nuclear power as its so-called green alternative in exports, so that Westinghouse is building dozens of new nuclear power plants in China as we speak. It has the contract to do that. And other third world countries as well are seeing a resurgence in the use of nuclear power as something that's been aggressively exported by the United States.
Yeah, meanwhile, the disposal problems haven't been solved yet.
The disposal problems haven't been solved yet. The federal government is suing to prevent the Hanford Waste Cleanup Initiative that was on the ballot and passed here in Washington in November from taking effect. They don't want to see that pass because they don't have to deal with the waste from nuclear power.
Right. And I made a mistake even calling it disposal. It's really long term storage. You can't dispose of something like that.
Yeah, exactly. But there were a number of other stories as well. As long as we're talking about energy, you could mention the politics and economics of oil as something that was not really covered that much. We have any number of different types of stories from intervention in the Middle East, and of course you really can't talk about Iraq without talking about oil. Something I forgot to mention during this week in Iraq is the tremendous gas shortages that are going on in Iraq right now and in Baghdad. Even though they have the second largest oil reserves in the world, the insurgency there is blowing up the pipelines and making it very difficult for people to get gas in Baghdad. So that's intrinsic to that story there. You have all of these different alliances being created by pipeline deals between, say, Russia and Japan. China locking up long-term reserves in Venezuela and other places in South America and Africa. What's been happening in the Ukraine and what's been happening in Georgia and some of the other Central Asia countries has very much to do with oil reserves there. This is something that we never talk about, is this country's utter dependence on foreign oil and fossil fuel. And what that means to our foreign policy, and what that means to the livelihoods of millions of people around the world, and we never talk about our dependence on this drug and what we need to do to wean ourselves from it,
and how totally integrated it is into our economy. In fact, they really shouldn't even mention the word economy. Without it, should be called oil economy.
I think that's probably very true. And at the same time, you have all of these emerging new technologies that are very much possible, very much economically possible. Certainly corporations can make money off of them, where Japan and Europe are leading the way in the development of these new technologies, because we're not paying attention to it here, because the government and the Bush administration aren't providing for tax credits or other incentives for companies to get involved in these technologies. And so we're going to be left behind. We're going to be left behind as these new technologies are developed elsewhere and then imported here.
It kind of reminds me of when I was younger and the U.S. Fell behind on cars, on car technology.
When suddenly you started getting all of these imported Toyotas and Datsuns and,
that were great cars.
Yeah, and filled the need. There were other stories, of course. Continuing corporate scandals is something that we've talked about here on this program. Fannie Mae, for example, having accounting quote-unquote errors that rival anything that was ever done by Enron or WorldCom. And that all happened on the watch after the supposed safeguards were passed in 2001 to prevent this kind of thing. In point of fact, continuing corporate scandals have been continuing pretty routinely ever since then, without very much being done by the Bush administration to curb them in. And you don't read about it except on the business pages of places like the Wall Street Journal. It really hasn't been covered very well. You have a tremendous story that has not gotten much attention, is that not every vote was counted in the election, that we really have a dysfunctional democracy in a lot of ways, that we have evidence in Ohio and Florida and a number of other states of voting irregularities and suppression of votes and various other problems with the democracy that would shame most third world countries.
Even here in Snohomish County.
Yeah, very much so.
Just north of us.
And, it's not necessarily that these were intentional errors, but even if they're not intentional, the fact that not every vote counts is something that should disturb all of us when we supposedly work in a democratic society.
They're supposedly exporting democracy elsewhere.
Yeah, they're trying to teach other people how to do it when we could take a few lessons ourselves.
I think we need to do a product recall.
Yeah, something like that. Certainly the quality control hasn't been very much up to speed.
No, I think they actually fired that department long ago.
Yeah. Interesting story this year is that South America has been gradually taken over by left-leaning governments that have been standing up to Washington in issues of global trade. The fact that the WTO and the Free Trade Area of the Americas and other multilateral institutions have been brought to a standstill by the opposition of Brazil and Venezuela and other global South countries that have very much stood up to Washington as a result of governments being elected, many of them as a result of popular demonstrations and popular uprisings in virtually, with the exception of Colombia, every country in South America now. It's something where the people of South America are expressing their will, and they're voting against George Bush and the politics of Washington, D.C.
They're doing real elections down there. And then you have to point out, too, then the U.S. response to things like in Venezuela is to try and form a coup.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was that didn't get covered either. That we had absolute evidence now through a Freedom of Information Act again that the Bush administration had advanced knowledge of and probably assisted in the participation of the attempted coup in April 2001 against Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And then last but not least, virtually anything that happens on the ground in Iraq, and of course that's why we have This Week in Iraq on this program every week, is because there is so much that goes uncovered that is actually happening in Iraq. And, you know, admittedly, it's difficult to report from on the ground in Iraq, but there's no excuse for taking credibly what the White House has to say on Iraq. It's simply it bears no relationship to reality and what's actually happening. And there's a whole host of stories that are waiting to be told from the lack of reconstruction progress and the corruption in the administration of reconstruction dollars to the fraudulence of the elections and the handover of power, whether it has to do with the occupation or whether it has to do with the war, there's a lot of stories that are still needing to be told.
Right, the 100,000 plus Iraqi deaths that was
they were reported by Lancet a couple months ago.
All right. Well, still plenty to cover on that, but
we'll do our best on that in 2005.
That's right. Eat the State, even though it's 2005, you guys are still looking to play a little catch up on the fundraiser for 2004.
Yeah, we're just closing it out. Actually, this will be the last week that we hector you on it. Not that we don't need money all of the time, but Eat the State is the community newspaper that Maria and I help co-edit and help put out every couple of weeks, and covers all of these stories, both globally and locally. It costs money to print the paper. It costs money to mail it out. Those are our two main expenses. The expenses come to about $800 for each issue every couple of weeks, and that means $1,500-$1,600 a month that we have to raise, and we've been falling way behind short on that. And so we need your help. If you're looking to make year-end tax-deductible donations or donations of any kind, we certainly appreciate it. You can do that on the web at www.eatthestate.org or through the mail to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. We really need it. It's a project that's been going on for 9-10 years now, and it's virtually all volunteer. We always need people to help out, whether it's with the distribution or selling ads for the display ads that we have in our paper, or writing and researching stories, all of those things. We can always use the help, but financial help is the easiest and most direct way to plug in.
And it's been financial help like that that's gotten you this far for 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a shoestring operation where we have just enough money in the bank after one issue to print for the next issue, or maybe even not enough then, but our printer's kind enough to float us an issue or two. It's always been hand-to-mouth. We don't get any big fancy corporate grants. We don't have any backing like that. It's always been the readers and people who appreciate what we do that have kept us alive. So hopefully we'll keep doing that in 2005.
Yeah. So a big thank you to those that have contributed over the years.
Yeah, but, absolutely. We need your help.
To continue.
Yep, very much so.
All right. And talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State. And what are we missing all that? Did you give your phone number?
We did not give our phone number. We did not tell you where you could find copies of Eat This State, which is it's a free paper. So you find it at bookstores and cafes and wherever you pick up your free periodicals, or you can find it again on the web at www.eatthestate.org, and all 9 years of back issues are there also if you really want to do a lot of reading on things that you thought you'd forgotten about. It's all there for you. If you want to help out, if you want to volunteer, or if you want more information about making a donation, anything like that, give our voicemail a call. It's area code 206-903-9461.